It's 5 o'clock p.m. on a warm and sunny evening in August 2016. The weather in Queens, New York is a perfect 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Many New Yorkers are just getting off of work, and it's a perfect opportunity to get outside into the fresh summer air for a nice long jog. And that is exactly what 30-year-old Karina Ventrano did. She laced up her running shoes, put some headphones in, and headed outside for a late afternoon jog, something that she did every single day. The sun is shining. There's still plenty of light out. There's plenty of people around. What is there to be afraid of? Karina Ventrano would have no idea that this would be her very last jog around Spring Creek Park, New York. But even with a taped video confession and a DNA profile that matched, would that be enough to put a selfish and cowardly killer behind bars? This week on Forensic Tales, we cover the murder of Karina Ventrano. Welcome to Forensic Tales. I'm your host, Courtney. Each Monday, we release a new episode that discusses real, bone-chilling true crime stories and how forensic science has been used in the case. Some cases have been solved through cutting-edge forensic techniques, while other cases have been left sitting on the shelf, collecting dust in the cold case division, just waiting to be solved by forensic science. If you love the show, please subscribe and leave us a review. This will greatly help promote the show to other true crime addicts. Also, please consider supporting the show on Patreon at patreon.com/forensictales. Patreon is an amazing platform that helps support small businesses and productions just like my show. This is also where you can access Patreon-only content, like bonus episodes and extras from the show. A huge thank you to our new Patreons this week to Forensic Tales, Nicole Leasing and Tony Areola. You guys rock. So please visit patreon.com/forensictales to get even more true crime content not available on the show. Now, let's get to our story. The story we're covering this week is another case that hits super close to home for me and the entire running community. As you guys may know, I'm an avid marathon runner and I have been for years. So when something like this happens in the running community, it really affects each and every one of us. It's a story that I have personally followed very closely since the story first broke in 2016. The case involved a beautiful young woman who was only 3 years older than me, and she became a victim doing something that I do practically every single day. She was running. The case reminded me of how vulnerable we really are, even doing the things that we enjoy doing every day. And we don't even think twice about doing them. I know, for me personally, this case reminded me of the importance of staying safe while running, like carrying pepper spray with me on a regular basis, and making sure I do my best to run in areas that I'm familiar with and are surrounded by other people. But even after taking all the precautions we possibly can, this story didn't happen in some dark alley. It happened in broad daylight. And it could happen to me, and it could happen to you. I'm talking about the murder of Karina Ventrano. Karina Ventrano was born on July 12, 1986, in the city of New York. Karina grew up in a super close-knit and loving family. Her parents, Philip and Kathy Ventrano, had two other children together, and the family lived in the city of Queens, New York. Karina's father, Philip, was actually a retired New York City Fire Department firefighter who was one of the first responders at Ground Zero after the September 11th terrorist attacks on the World Trade Centers in New York. So Karina and her family were pretty much what you would describe as true New Yorkers. Karina attended Archbishop Molly High School in Queens, New York, which is a pretty highly renowned private Catholic school for grades 9th through 12th. When she graduated from high school, she went on to college and then eventually decided she wanted to pursue a master's degree. So she decided on St. John's University, which is also a private Roman Catholic university in the heart of New York City. And she graduated from the university with a master's degree in speech pathology. She really wanted to help others who were dealing with speech and language disorders, and she even wanted to be able to work with children who were diagnosed with autism who struggled to communicate. But Karina also had a lot of other passions and interests in her life. She absolutely loved to write. She even had dreams to one day become a famous writer herself. Her passion for writing was even featured in a 2013 short film titled The Paradox that her friend and screenwriter wrote and produced. Karina Vintrano had a pretty large following on social media. She had a huge following on Instagram, like she literally had thousands of followers. She was known on social media for her selfies, and you guys, Karina was absolutely beautiful. She posted pictures on her Instagram from different trips around the world that she took to just regular, everyday selfies of herself. Her presence on social media really grew every single day. She also had a blog that she called, quote, a collection of conversations, contradictions, and poetic conflicts. And although it was a completely public blog, Karina really used it as a platform to share some pretty deep personal feelings and thoughts that she experienced as a young 30-year-old. An aspect to her blog that will definitely take on a whole new meaning was that she actually wrote a blog post in which she imagined and wrote about what her very own funeral would be like someday. A portion of that blog post read, quote, "Have you ever found solace in the thought of dying? Sometimes when I'm feeling really sad and lonely and misunderstood, I wonder if right now, at this age and at this time of my life, if by some freak accident I died, what would happen? I think about all of the different people from different times of my life that would attend my funeral," end quote. But her blog also talked about things like sex and relationships. It was really just Karina's way to communicate with her massive online following. In 2016, Karina Vintrano was 30 years old, living and working in Queens, New York. She had a job working with children who were diagnosed with autism, and she also worked as a caterer at Vetro Restaurant and Wine Bar in the city. She was still super close with her parents and siblings and only lived a short distance away. One of the things that Karina loved to do was to go jogging with her dad, Philip. She loved to jog because it's obviously a great way to stay in shape, but I also would imagine that it was a way to spend a little bit more time with her dad. Karina and her dad were known to go jogging together pretty much every single day. So on August 2nd, 2016, Karina asks her dad if he wants to go jogging together, like they did pretty much every day. But Philip tells his daughter that he's not really up for it today because his back had been bothering him. And maybe it was a father's intuition or something else. But Philip even told his daughter that he really didn't want her to go out for that run that afternoon. But Karina didn't think too much into what her father said, and she still wanted to get her workout in for the day. So that is exactly what Karina Vintrano did on August 2nd, 2016. She kissed her father goodbye and said, "It's okay, Daddy, I'll be all right," and off she went. Karina started her jog on August 2nd in the late afternoon around Spring Creek Park. Spring Creek Park is a place where she always went running, and the park was only about a block away from her house. The park is a place that has a lot of undeveloped marshlands, and it really only has a small portion that the public can even access. But for Karina, this was a super convenient place that was really close to her house that she could go out and start her run. Even though this was a convenient running spot for Karina, the area around Spring Creek Park wasn't exactly what you would describe as the best place to be out jogging. And that's mostly because it's described as being a magnet for transients to kind of hang around. So if you're a beautiful 30-something-year-old female, to be out in the area running might be a little scary. But Karina went out for her jog in the late afternoon. The sun was still shining. It wasn't even dark at all. So if I was her, I don't think I would even think twice. I would probably put my running shoes on, pop some headphones in, and just go do my thing. But once Karina doesn't return home around the same time that she always did, her father starts to worry about his daughter. Because her dad usually runs with her, he has a pretty solid idea of when she typically returns home. So he calls Karina on her cell phone, thinking that, well, maybe she ran into someone she knew out there on the run or something. But on this first phone call, Karina doesn't answer her phone, which is strange because her father knew that she always picked up his calls. So he calls again and again. And he calls again, but Karina never picks up the phone calls. Karina's father, Philip, is a retired New York City firefighter, so he has a lot of connections to the New York police and fire departments. So Philip decides that Karina is way past when she normally comes home from her runs, and she's not answering any of his phone calls, that it's time to call his neighbor and friend, who just so happens to be an NYPD police chief, and an official search is launched for Karina. Philip Ventrano joins the NYPD search team looking for Karina. They start searching the marshy area all around Spring Creek Park. Again, because Philip usually runs with his daughter, he knows exactly what route she would have gone on earlier that afternoon. Philip and the NYPD search for Karina for hours, but there is no sign of the 30-year-old anywhere. After a couple hours, around 11 p.m. that night, Philip Ventrano himself found his daughter's lifeless body face down about 15 feet away from the closest walking trail. Now, I can't even begin to imagine what it must have been like for Philip to be the one to discover his very own daughter's body out there, just thrown away like a piece of trash. It's absolutely terrible and horrifying, and is something that absolutely no father, or anyone for that matter, should ever have to go through or experience. And when Philip discovered his daughter's body, she only had some of her clothes on, and she was absolutely covered in scratches and bruises from head to toe. It didn't take a medical examiner to know that Karina Ventrano fought for her life against whoever her attacker was. And it also didn't take a medical examiner to know that she was brutally murdered that evening. An autopsy the following day revealed that Karina had been sexually assaulted and the cause of death was strangulation. It appeared to the medical examiner that Karina had been struck in the back of the head with most likely a rock. And when I say that Karina fought for her life, I mean she really fought. She bit her attacker so hard that it actually cracked her teeth. Police and the medical examiner found grass underneath her fingernails, revealing that while she was being dragged off that running trail, she was fighting to stay away from her attacker. Karina had been strangled so tightly that day that the medical examiner could make out a full handprint around her neck. Fortunately for police, the medical examiner was also able to recover the DNA of her attacker from underneath her fingernails, on her back, and on her cell phone, which was located in the grass just a couple hundred yards away from where Karina's body was discovered. Police were hopeful that with this DNA profile, it would lead them directly to her killer. After Karina's autopsy, the NYPD announced a $10,000 reward for any information that would lead police closer to her killer. Her family and the entire community were desperate to find the person that could do something like this to someone as beautiful as Karina. But the DNA found underneath Karina's fingernails, on her back, and on her cell phone didn't immediately lead police to a suspect in the case. Even after the DNA sample was run through local and national DNA databases, police were unable to get an exact match or hit from the sample. In fact, over the course of the investigation, over 600 DNA samples would be examined, none of which would come back as a match to Karina's killer. The investigation and hunt for Karina Ventrano's killer was heartbreaking. Police investigators would go on to check over 1,700 investigative reports and follow over 250 leads in the case. But each investigative report and lead would lead them no closer to finding their suspect. It appeared to police that they were dealing with a random act of violence committed by a random stranger, which makes for an extremely difficult case to try and solve. Karina didn't have any enemies. She wasn't involved in the wrong crowd. She was a 30-year-old woman who decided to go out for a run in a place that she always ran. She wasn't doing anything that would put her at risk, or so she thought. With the DNA sample leading to no arrest and none of the leads panning out, the Ventrano family was feeling pretty discouraged and heartbroken by the investigation. But then, 5 days after Karina Ventrano was found brutally murdered in a meadow of unkept weeds, 27-year-old Vanessa Teresa Marcotte was found murdered in Princeton, Massachusetts. Similar to Karina, Vanessa was also out for a jog when she was attacked. The similarities between Vanessa and Karina were basically impossible for police investigators to ignore. Both ladies were around the same age, they were both out for a jog alone, and they were both attacked along a rural and empty route. So police in New York and police in Princeton were wondering, was it possible these two murders are related? Well, as quickly as the idea came up that these two attacks might be related, it came to an even quicker end. And that's because the DNA found at the crime scene in Princeton didn't match the DNA that was found in New York, meaning that the murders were committed by two different suspects. It was just a huge and extremely unfortunate coincidence, for a lack of a better word, that Vanessa and Karina were both killed in very similar manners, but by two different perpetrators. So going back to the case of Karina Ventrano, police had a DNA sample that they had collected from the crime scene, but they weren't able to get a match right away. So while the crime lab continues to test the DNA sample, police investigators release a sketch to the public on August 31st of the man they believe is a person of interest in the case. And this sketch was based on a description provided by a utility worker who witnessed a man coming out of the weeds and running on a path by Belt Parkway around the same time that Karina was murdered. So whether or not this person of interest was responsible for her murder, police at the very least wanted to talk to him and find out anything that he might have seen or knew about the attack that afternoon. But even after the sketch was released to the public, police didn't receive any leads that would lead them to an arrest in the case. A little less than 2 weeks go by from the release of the sketch when the popular true crime show Crime Watch Daily released a home surveillance video that captured Karina while out on her run. Crime Watch Daily was a very popular investigative news series that was hosted by Chris Hansen, the journalist who also hosted To Catch a Predator. So Crime Watch Daily released the home surveillance video that captured Karina jogging around 5 p.m. on the afternoon she was killed. And in the video, Karina is seen jogging past a white small sedan wearing black shorts and a black sports bra. Her hair was up in a ponytail, and when I watched the short clip, it looks like she's holding what looks like her cell phone in one of her hands, like she was probably listening to music as she jogged. The video is widely available on the internet, so if you guys want to watch it for yourself, you can just Google or YouTube the Karina Ventrano tape, and you're going to get about a dozen of different links. You can only see Karina for about a few seconds before she jogs out of view from the home surveillance camera. As she jogs across the screen, she passes another darker-colored vehicle, looks to me like a small SUV, and then Karina Ventrano is simply gone. This is the last known footage of her alive. A couple months go by in the investigation into Karina's murder. Even with the DNA sample found at the crime scene, the sketch of the person seen running from the general area of where Karina was attacked, and the home surveillance footage of her jogging, police are still unable to make an arrest in the case. So by December, 4 months after Karina's murder, the FBI partners with the NYPD to assist in the investigation. The FBI and the NYPD jointly develop a criminal profile of who they think might have killed Karina. Investigators believed that whoever killed Karina was likely very familiar with the area. That's because the killer felt confident enough that he would be able to grab her and attack her without the chance of anyone seeing or hearing the assault taking place. Criminal profilers also believed that the suspect has most likely stopped visiting or living in the park. Especially if the killer was transient, they most likely moved out of the area after the attack. He may have even shared with others that he moved out of the area because he feared for his safety after learning about Karina's murder. By the end of 2016, the GoFundMe page that was created by the Ventrano family in order to provide a reward fund to anyone with information on the case reached over $290,000. And the Ventrano family was desperate for answers as to who brutally murdered Karina and why. The family became very outspoken about their desire to find the person responsible for the murder. They made several media appearances pushing for police to utilize familial DNA, which is exactly how the Golden State Killer would eventually be caught. The family lobbied lawmakers to pass laws that would make familial DNA testing a normal police practice. This was a big deal in the investigation, because remember, the police had the suspect's DNA. They just didn't have a person to match it against. So familial DNA testing would allow for the DNA sample to be tested against people who may be related to the suspect. Again, months continued to go by without a major break in the case, until February 4th, 2017, nearly 6 months after the murder. the NYPD announced to the public that they have taken a suspect into custody for questioning regarding Karina's murder. They identified the suspect as 20-year-old Brooklyn resident Chanel Lewis. Chanel Lewis was a 20-year-old Brooklyn resident who was living in a low-income housing project with his mom, his two sisters, and their children at the time of Karina's murder. Lewis was an honors student at a local college and was working towards becoming a social worker once he finished school. The housing project building that Lewis lived in with his family was located less than 3 miles from the park where Karina was found murdered. So although Lewis had no criminal record, he did have a number of run-ins with law enforcement prior to being brought in for questioning. He was no stranger to the criminal justice system. Lewis had 2 prior summons, both from 2013, for violating rules in Spring Creek Park, exactly where Karina's body was discovered. He also had another ticket for urinating in public from 2013. In May 2016, a call came in to 911 reporting a suspicious male holding a crowbar in the backyard of several residents' home, later identified as Chanel Lewis. In addition to the contacts with the criminal justice system, Lewis also had a history of displaying hatred towards women. Reports indicate that Lewis told one of his teacher's aides that he wanted to, quote, stab all the girls in school, which, of course, under any circumstance, is extremely alarming and is just downright scary behavior for any teenager to display. So the NYPD arrest and question Lewis on the suspicion that he may have murdered Karina, largely based on tips and leads that were provided to the police by the community. The leads indicated that after Lewis returned home on August 2nd, his clothes were torn and he looked very disheveled. Lewis told his mother that the reason why his clothes were torn was because he actually had been mugged by a group of men on the streets. Police also learned that on August 3rd, the day after Karina was killed, Lewis was taken to the local hospital by his father to treat some pretty bad cuts and wounds that he had on his arms and upper body. New York police detectives obtained hospital records that proved Lewis was treated by emergency room doctors the day after Karina's murder. The medical report also indicated that besides the cuts and scratches to his upper body, Lewis was also treated for a hand injury. Taking all this into consideration, police thought it was likely that Lewis's injuries were as a result of the attack on Karina. During the police interview, Lewis actually voluntarily provided his DNA to be tested against the DNA found underneath Karina's fingernails, on her back, and on her cell phone. Chanel Lewis was interviewed and questioned by police for over 4 hours on Sunday, February 5th, 2017. He was interviewed by 2 LAPD investigators and 2 assistant district attorneys at the 107th Precinct Station in Ponomac, Queens. And I apologize in advance to any of my New York listeners if I butchered that. There is actually a video that is about 28 minutes long on YouTube, provided by the Queens Daily Eagle, that shows investigators advising Lewis of his rights to remain silent throughout the interview. And when asked if he waived his rights to remain silent, he takes a moment and then says, "Okay, yes." Police go on to ask Lewis about where he was on the afternoon of August 2nd, 2016. And he admits to them that he was in the park where Karina's body was discovered. Police ask Lewis if something happened when he was in the park that day. And he tells police that yes, something happened. He goes on to tell them that he saw a woman jogging in the park by herself and that something happened. Lewis said when he saw her jogging, he was on the trail just walking and listening to music. According to Lewis, when Karina jogged past him on the trail, he grabbed her around the shoulders and started repeatedly hitting her until she fell to the ground. And this began the confession to Karina Ventrano's murder. The police interview goes on to describe some pretty detailed information about what Lewis did with Karina and how he brutally murdered her that day that I don't want to get into on this show, mostly out of respect for her and her family. But ultimately, Chanel Lewis issues a full confession to the murder of Karina Ventrano. Chanel Lewis was formally charged with one count of second-degree murder. While in custody, New York prosecutors begin building their case against Lewis. Prosecutors believe that on August 2, 2016, Lewis left his mom's apartment after getting into an argument with his family. He walked over to Spring Creek Park, and that's where he encountered Karina, who was out on her jog. Prosecutors don't know if Lewis had ever seen Karina before the attack, and if so, if he had premeditated the attack before he did it. But prosecutors felt like their case against Lewis was strong enough without knowing his exact motive. Prosecutors felt good about the case because they had a taped confession where Lewis admitted to police that he did kill Karina that day. And they had the DNA from Karina's body and cell phone that was an original match to Lewis's DNA. So the trial against Chanel Lewis for the murder of Karina Ventrano began on November 5th, 2018. By this point, prosecutors charged Lewis for murder as well as a sex abuse charge for the sexual assault. This was obviously a very serious case in New York, and if convicted, Lewis was facing a 25 years to life in prison. The prosecutors presented a lot of evidence at the trial. They started with Philip Ventrano, Karina's father, taking the stand to explain to the jury how he was the one responsible and in charge of creating the initial search party to find his missing daughter. And as heartbreaking as it must have been for him, he described in detail to the jury what it was like for him to find his daughter in the way that he did. After Philip's testimony, the prosecution played Lewis's confession tape, where he essentially admitted in detail to Karina's murder that afternoon. Up next for the prosecution was Linda Rizzano, a forensic biologist who took the stand to speak to the DNA evidence that was recovered from underneath Karina's fingernails, on her back, and on her cell phone. And during her testimony, Linda Rizzano told the jury that the DNA evidence recovered from the scene had a 1 in a 6 trillion chance of belonging to someone other than Lewis. Meaning that the DNA absolutely belonged to Lewis and absolutely proved that Lewis made contact with Karina that afternoon. And the prosecutors wanted the jury to know that it's important to remember where the DNA was found at the scene, like underneath Karina's fingernails, kind of saying there's no logical explanation why his DNA would be found underneath her fingernails without suggesting that there must have been a struggle between Karina and Lewis. So after the prosecution rested its case against Lewis, the assistant district attorney, Brad Lowenthal, came forward to the court and requested that 9 counts against Lewis be dismissed, leaving just 4 counts, including 1 of first-degree murder, 2 of second-degree murder, and 1 for first-degree sexual assault. The judge accepted the DA's offer, and then it became time for the defense team to present their defense to the jury. Lewis's defense team attacked the police for how they obtained the videotaped confession from him, They argued that the police only videotaped after Lewis had said that he agreed to waive his right to remain silent. They said that the police talked to Lewis for hours before the tape started recording. And they basically argued that during the time before the videotape was rolling, the police were pressuring Lewis to confess to the murder. And if that's the case, then his confession would have to be thrown out because the confession was made under duress, which by our standards of law is illegal. Confessions in the U.S. should be made by one's own free will and of sound mind. Which I can kind of understand the point that the defense team is raising here, just to play devil's advocate. Because Lewis was reportedly at the police station for hours, but only 30 minutes of the tape was actually played for the jury. So I can understand how this could create a gap in the timeline of events related to his confession. But overall, I just don't think it's a very strong argument. The defense team also challenged the prosecution's key piece of forensic evidence, Lewis's DNA found underneath Karina's fingernails. The defense said that the amount of DNA recovered from the scene was so small that it couldn't possibly produce an accurate DNA profile. The defense argued that the NYPD did a sloppy job at securing the crime scene that day. They pointed out the fact that Philip, Karina's father, picked up the body after he discovered her, therefore contaminating the scene right from the beginning. The defense summed up their argument by driving it home to the jury that the police simply rushed to judgment in this case. That the forensic evidence wasn't strong enough, the scene was contaminated from the get-go, and even though he confessed to the murder, he did it while under duress. They argued that the only logical verdict from the jury would have to be a full and complete acquittal. Once the prosecution and defense rested, it went into the hands of the jury to decide Lewis's fate. The jury deliberated for about a day and a half, and to many people's surprise, myself included, they were hung. So not the acquittal that the defense was asking for, but certainly not a conviction for the state. So on November 21st, 2018, the judge had no choice but to declare a mistrial in the case. Which I can only imagine the absolute heartbreak the Ventrano family must have felt when the decision was read. But it also means that the prosecution can decide to retry the case in hopes of getting a conviction the second time around. And that's exactly what the state of New York does. The second trial for Chanel Lewis began in March 2019. And just like in the first trial, prosecutors decided to play the full confession tape to the jury. This time, they made it clear that before they started recording the interview, they weren't pressuring Lewis to make a statement or confess to the murder. But police were actually waiting for hours while Lewis sat in a Queens, New York holding cell watching cartoons until he voluntarily decided to sit down and talk with them. And just like the first trial, prosecutors told the jury about the DNA evidence found on Karina's body and how it was an exact match to Chanel Lewis. The jury in Lewis's second murder trial didn't have to deliberate very long. In fact, they were only deliberated for about 5 hours before coming back with a guilty verdict on 2 counts of second-degree murder, 1 count of first-degree murder, and 1 count of sexual assault on April 1st, 2019. Chanel Lewis was supposed to be back in court about 2 weeks later on April 17th for his sentencing hearing. But just a few days prior to the hearing, Lewis's defense counsel requested a delay because they believed that they had enough evidence of jury misconduct during the second trial. And if that was true, that would mean that Lewis might actually be entitled to a brand new criminal trial. But his defense team really wasn't able to produce any solid evidence to suggest that anyone on the jury in the second trial did anything wrong or anything illegal. So the judge decided to go forward with sentencing Lewis for Karina's murder. So on April 23rd, 2019, Lewis was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for the murder of Karina Ventrano. At his sentencing hearing, Lewis decided to speak directly to the judge and the Ventrano family, and basically said that he's an innocent man and that he's not the one responsible for killing Karina. He said, quote, "I'm sorry for the family's loss, but I didn't do this," end quote. Karina's father, Philip, also spoke at the sentencing hearing, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. Phil told the judge, quote, "That monster is responsible for killing four people the night of August 2nd. One is in heaven. The other three walk the earth as zombies, just waiting to die to be with Karina again. There is no more pleasure in life," end quote. Since Chanel Lewis was sentenced to life in prison, his defense team has made two separate attempts to get him a new trial, largely based on the claim that an anonymous letter was mailed to them by an alleged law enforcement officer before closing arguments, claiming prosecutorial misconduct and a jury-claimed misconduct during jury deliberations. As of today in 2020, both of these motions for a new trial have been denied, and there is no plan for Lewis to get a new trial in the near future. Chanel Lewis's family still stands by him and his innocence today. Even with the overwhelming DNA evidence that links him to the crime and the videotaped confession, his family still stands by his side and are still fighting for a new trial. Although Karina Ventrano's family has the justice and peace of mind knowing that Karina's killer will spend the rest of his life behind bars, this justice will never bring her back. Karina was a beautiful, smart, and loved woman who was simply taken from this world far too early. She had so much life ahead of her that she will never get to experience, because Chanel Lewis took it away from her. Thank you to Forensic Science and DNA Evidence for putting Chanel Lewis behind bars for the rest of his life. Forensic Science takes another killer off the street. Forensic Tales is a Rockefeller Audio production. To read more about the murder of Karina Ventrano and check out photos from the case, check out our website, ForensicTales.com. And if you love the show, please make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to leave us a rating with a review. I would love to hear your feedback. Consider supporting the show on Patreon. If you'd like to help me to continue to produce the true crime content you just can't get enough of, please visit patreon.com/forensictales. Forensic Tales is a podcast made possible by our own Patreon producers, Tony Areola and Nicole Leasing. If you'd like to become a Patreon producer of the show, please check out our page or email me at Courtney@ForensicTales.com to find out how you can become involved. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Join me next week. We release a new episode each and every Monday to satisfy your true crime obsession. Until then, remember, not all stories have happy endings.